Now more stain-fighting power. Versatile stain removers from laundry, carpets, grease and grime, outdoor furniture, decks. Caution, injurious to eyes, harmful if swallowed, keep out of reach of children. See cautions on back panel. Diesel and Clooney.
Chris?
Yeah.
Like, dude,
pretty good intro.
Are you just reading the OxyClean bottle?
Yeah, a little bit. Our intro this week is brought to you by the stain removing power of OxyClean.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Who we wish was some type of a sponsor, right?
Yeah. was a freebie, OxyClean.
You're welcome, OxyClean.
You like that? Because there's plenty more. Mm-hmm. Plenty more where that came from. I'll read whatever product is in front of me. And it is in front of me.
That's perfect.
It really is. So there we go. Oh, Jerry, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too. How are you, man?
Oh, I'm doing all right, actually. And dear Lester the listener.
Lester the listener.
We hope you're well. We hope you're well, Lester. Mm-hmm. You know, Jerry, there wasn't even a segue for that tone, but I am just...
Wow, yeah. I'm not sure what you're going to segue from. Yeah.
Believe it or not, good old Lester the listener made me think, you know what, Jerry, we had so much fun on our last episode. Talking about cognitive bias, and and we kind of ended the episode, and I thought to myself, this is just scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. It's just the surface. I think we've ignited an itch, Jerry. I've ignited a cognitive bias itch, and I need ointment. I need ointment for my cognitive biases.
Yes,
I'm still not sure what the plural of that is. I've ignited. I've got cognitive bias inflammation.
Yep.
This sounds worse and worse the longer I go down this road.
There is a cream for that. Yeah.
Oh, we need the ointment. But rather than just jump in and you know, try to salve all of the wounds, let's diagnose things first. So I thought maybe, Jerry, we could have a sequel Ooh. Right after the first one. Normally we have, you know, a little breather episode in between. But no, we're jumping right into sequels. So we'll do cognitive bias number two.
Yeah, that was a good conversation last time. I enjoy picking that stuff apart from the perspective of you and I.
Well, that's just it, because you know, many of us probably have heard of some of these biases, but to me, they are fascinating in the context of the intercultural world and of people who live as global nomads. And those are our people, Jerry.
Those are our people.
So so let's should we crack on in?
What's that mean? Like,
should we get started? I may have several phrases there. Like, let's get cracking.
I've heard. Yeah.
Yep. And I threw it in. Let's crack on in. There we go. All right. So this first one, Jerry, is very aptly named. I thought the first cognitive bias that we could go over would be the just world hypothesis. Ooh. And that is the cognitive bias where we tend to believe the world is just, and therefore we assume that acts of injustice are deserved. So for example, if something bad happens to someone else, they're like,
they had it coming.
Had it coming because the world is just, and when they did something bad,
goes around.
Exactly.
Like we've got follow-up phrases for that, right? Like we've got the whole idea that they're just desserts. Is this the same idea? Is this kind of a karma mentality? Like you did that, you get this.
I think it's somewhat related. And I think maybe, you know, karma, I would say, that's more of a philosophy. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the cognitive bias is maybe where that's misapplied. And I think if you think about that on sort of the international context, or if you're going through intercultural moves, if you're having to deal with other cultures, I can see where this might creep in, just because I think there's a lot of different ideas on what just would be. I mean, you think about, you know, one of the big ways to break down break down the world is to look at sort of a group that I work with, Knowledge Works. They call it the three colors of worldview. And they talk about how each of us have a mix of them, but how we've got some of us tend more toward innocence and guilt. Some tend more toward honor and shame, and some tend more toward power and fear. So even just on that, you know, what you think is just might look different in each one of those scenarios. So that might be a really jarring thing if you're coming from one perspective. If you're thinking, oh, you know, it's innocence and guilt. So the world is just, and if you harm someone, then you're guilty, and it'll come back to you. Whereas maybe the context you're in, what's just is more about honor, and so. Mm-hmm. You know, you could actually, there could be a lot of mixed signals between those around you.
And regardless of where it's coming from, it feels like this one has kind of an internal reasoning that's going on. Like I'm trying to make sense of what's happening here. Why would this happen? It seems rational. It seems reasonable to me that you're a jerk. So you've got what's coming to you, right? Like, and it makes me feel better inside to think that the rationale for why bad things happen to you is because you were a jerk to me. Then we get stuck in the why would anything good ever happen to you? Why do good things happen to bad people? I totally agree with you. I think there's such a relativity to how we define bad people, how we define bad actions, how we define who the heroes and villains of any story are. And then, you know, whether something that happens to them is good or bad, it's almost entirely based on our bias, on our assessment of who that person is and how it impacts us.
Yeah. Well, and also how much we're perceived. I mean, I think about the times where, you know, I'm traveling perhaps in a context different from my own. We talked, I think, in the last episode quite a bit about queuing. My gosh, I'm always going to bring up queuing, Jerry. Mm-hmm. Always. Where, you know, in my mind, for someone to jump a queue is just, you know, I probably do default to this bias. And I'm like, oh, that person, you know, if I saw someone jump a queue and then later on I saw them scrambling and missed their flight, and I would think, well, they deserve that. They're a queue jumper.
Yeah,
You know, that makes sense in my context. But I wonder how often I have actually, you know, been the object of someone's ire because of things that I've done, thinking that I'm righteous when it doesn't actually fit what's about me. You know, how many times have people, you know, perhaps then not wanted to help me because things I've done, even unknowing, register as unjust to them? Yeah. I mean, I think about even just priorities, whereas for me, you know, a priority for me is to keep the peace. So often I will avoid conflict, and I can definitely see how sometimes people are like, well, you know, you got what you deserve, Chris, because you probably should have had that argument.
Yeah.
But in my mind, I'm like, no, I was doing a good thing. I saved us from fighting.
You know,
and that is, so we may wish that.
Yeah. Have you seen like the YouTube phenomenon, instant karma?
Oh, I have seen a few, yeah.
It strikes me as you're talking how many of those have some close connection to queuing. So, like, what I'm saying is I don't think you're the only one who wrestles with queuing as a I think the fact that some of the most popular videos in the world are like, yeah, he got it because he cut somebody off, or it's not just you, Chris.
Thank goodness.
It's all of us. Don't you cut in front of me or you'll get what's coming.
Well, it does. It speaks to the fact that, you know, I like the name of it, the just world hypothesis, because we would love it if it were a just world. It kind of makes me think, this is a little off topic, but you know what? I'm going there. One of the fascinating discussions that I once heard on conspiracy theories had to do with exactly this, that we sort of similar to a just world hypothesis, we also really want there to be balance. So we want there to be, we want big effects to have big causes. That just makes sense. And we want little effects to have little causes.
Right.
And so I think the example in the presentation I heard was the assassination of JFK. Lots of conspiracy theories surrounding that because it doesn't add up, because that was a huge effect. And the, the idea that just one man, you know, a seemingly small cause could have this, you know, massive, massive global repercussions doesn't add up. Whereas there was also an assassination attempt on U.S. President Reagan, but he was fine. So no one questions that. No one has any conspiracy theories about that. They're like, oh yeah, some crazy guy tried to shoot Reagan. Nothing really came of it. So that adds up. Little little cause, little effect. But we don't like it when little cause equals big effect, or when big cause only has little effect. So some conspiracy theories come from our want for balance. Possibly.
So
possibly.
Do you think if President Reagan had been killed, then in that assassination attempt, that the conspiracy theories would have...
Yeah, that makes sense. There'd probably be more. And I think that's the same thing we get to with this just world hypothesis. And so, you know, in order to address that, we probably just need to accept that it's not actually a just world. Unfair things happen. And sometimes, you know, little causes have big effects, and sometimes big causes have little effects. And sometimes good things happen to bad people, and sometimes bad things happen to good people. And
sometimes people are just jerks. Like,
sometimes people are
like,
just jerks. And they get away with it.
It would be interesting to explore this in the context of, like, the broader justice conversation, right? Like, there have been some incredibly, horribly unjust things happen in the world, right? And so it's like, how far out do you get until you come to that breaking point of, nope, that is like that's somebody just committing an act of injustice. That is power coming down on poverty. That people being destroyed simply because of the power dynamic or whatever.
And where does that idea hold up
for a little bit, but there has to be a breaking point at some point, I think.
Well, because it is, the world may not be balanced, but we want balance. And I would argue, and perhaps that's a fun cultural argument, is that in some ways, maybe culture is just different expressions of us trying to bring balance to a very unbalanced existence and world.
Yeah, you just went too deep for me, man.
It's too deep.
Yeah, wow.
Too deep, too quick.
Woo. That's good. That's good.
It's another podcast altogether.
It is,
exactly. Yeah. We might come back to that one. But moving along in cultural bias and how they may...
You got another one?
Oh, I do, Jerry. Mm. I've done my research, if you
What's
will.
This one called?
This one's called Anchoring. Anchoring. So, weigh, hey, anchor, and let's set sail on this cognitive bias ship of dreams. Anchoring? That was way too much of a commercial for anchoring. We should not be advertising cognitive bias, making it sound...
It's funny because in my head, I just saw like a giant cruise ship, and painted on the side of it was like the OxyClean.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, I would be aboard that ship. I bet it would. Mm-hmm. I bet it would smell nice. I bet it would smell clean.
It would.
So anchoring is when we rely heavily on the first piece of information introduced when making decisions. And the example I saw for this, and I fall for it, Jerry, I do, is, for instance, when items are on sale and they say, oh my gosh, that's 50% off. That must be a great deal.
Right.
And the reality is this happens more often than we would like. You know, it says 50% off. It's probably after
they
that sale
marked
price.
Marked it up 300%,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. It's not actually less. They've just manipulated the data, you know, to get us to that point. But we do tend to, whatever we hear first, that's what this bias says, whatever we hear first has a disproportionate amount of power and sway over us. Which, you think about the power that we have. Here's where I connected this interculturally. You think about the power that we have when we welcome new people to a place. Because I think about the different stages people are at. Like, I can remember being in places where they're like, I've adapted, you know, I've adapted to this country. Right. I can see it's good, bad, it's ugly, blah, blah, blah. And so the new person come in and they're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and thrilled to bits. And what you say to them, because they're probably anchoring, whether they know it or not, probably has disproportionately huge effect. And so if they happen to catch you on a bad day where you're like, ugh, the administration here is disastrous. Nothing worked. The parking is terrible. Blah, 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 blah. that's probably going to paint quite a bit of their image of a place, even if a whole bunch of other things are absolutely marvelous. If what you say first, they're going to anchor to that information.
Yeah. Like this takes me back to doing cross-cultural training for people just coming into a country, and just like I would beg people, take one question out of your vocabulary, and it is the question that you're most going to want to ask, right? And the question is why. And the reason you should take that out of your vocabulary is because why is too big of a question for any one person to answer. And the reality is that the first person who answers it is going to give you an answer based on their very limited understanding, no matter who they are. They're going to give you an answer, and you're going to accept it as fact, and you're just going to go on. And then every time somebody responds to you or talks to you about the why, you're going to be like, oh, yeah. Like, I understand why, because Bobby the expat told me why the second day I was here, and he's been here for a year and a half, right? Oh, that's like, Bobby, so you're asking about deep culture, like centuries, millennia old cultural tidbits, right? And you're like, why do they do this? And Bobby the expat, who's been there for 18 months, says, yeah, well, I don't know what accent Bobby has.
I was so excited to hear.
That's my accent. Well, I think he's Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan is
Bobby says, well, they do that because, you know. And he gives you some type of an answer about why. And he's and because he's Bobby and he's been there longer than you, you're like, well, you're the expert, dude. Like you understand this at a level that I could never. My begging training was, I will allow you to ask why if you commit to asking why 100 times, right? Go ask 100 different people why, and then you'll start to get a mosaic. You'll start to get a picture. You'll start to get some type. And actually what you'll realize is that why is too big of a question. Like, you can't understand the deep cultural sentiments that are hundreds, sometimes thousands of years old, by asking one person who's been there a little bit longer than you. But you tend to take the first answer that you get and you roll with it. And when you think you have an answer, you stop asking questions, right? Yeah. Like, why would I need to ask a question if I already know the answer? And Bobby the expat gave me the answer, right?
Oh, that's such a wise summation. And I think it could even be more than just the answer we get from people. I mean, I think about, for instance, I'm going to use Spain. This is going to be my public apology to Spain. Because
Are you apologizing? I'm getting mixed messages here.
I'm using them as an example.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and throw in an apology.
Okay.
Because I went to Spain. I've been there as a kid. And you know, that was good and fun and everything. But one of the first times that I went as an adult to Spain, I went to, there's this festival at this place, I think it's called Buñol, and it's the Tomatina. I think that's what it's called. And it's basically, Jerry, it's kind of fun. They close off this town and drape it in a bunch of plastic and then bring in tons, literal tons and tons and tons of tomatoes. And it's this giant tomato fight. Through the whole town, the streets, the truckloads of tomatoes come through, and at the end of it,
everyone
is just, you should look it up. It's loads of fun. So I did. A buddy of mine, we went to that, and it was loads of fun. But in the midst of all that, now it is a festival. You know, it attracts who knows how many thousands of people. My buddy's wallet was stolen, and that left a very sour taste. And it answered a question for me about Spain, you know, an unconscious question that said, you know, is Spain safe? Which, you know, that's way too broad to be able to answer. Yeah. But I did. I had written off Spain for a very long time because of that one incident, you know.
Yeah.
And now I'm pleased to say Spain has become one of my kind of European stop through my interchange for trans-European stuff now. And it's delightful. It's delightful. But it is that first piece of information, you know, that fills in. Like you said, we only ask a question when we don't have an answer. So the first answer you get, you stop inquiring. And I did it to Spain. I stopped inquiring as to whether or not it had anything else to give me. And so there is.
Yeah.
I like knowing about anchoring because I think being aware of it, you know, what great motivation to gather more information.
Yeah. It makes me think about, like, the term that I would use is frame of reference, right? So anytime you're going to experience something new or for the first time, you've got a frame of reference based on something, whatever it is, somebody else's opinion, a stereotype that you grew up with, a YouTube video, a movie, like there is an idea and you've got this frame of reference, and then experiencing that place, like there is the opportunity to expand the frame of reference, right? And so the question is, like, are you going to? So your frame of reference for Spain was kind of painted and tainted by this one experience, and that was your frame of reference, right?
Yep.
And you were unwilling to allow your frame of reference, you horrible, horrible expat you. You're not good at this at all, Chris.
I'm not.
You were unwilling because you had a view based on one experience that you were unwilling to allow that frame of reference to be expanded. And that one point taps into so much of how the world works, right?
Yeah.
We have an understanding based on whatever limited experience that we have, whatever assumptions that we have, that we're not willing to allow to be expanded. Yep. And that's tragedy. Like, that is the tragedy of the world, is that I understand it's what I always say about ignorance. Like, ignorance is not the problem. The fact that you don't know something is not the problem. The fact that you're acting like you do know something is the problem, right? Ooh. Like, you think you actually do know something. And so you're unaware of your own ignorance, and you're unwilling to allow that to be expanded and changed and transformed. That's why you're stuck. That's why a lot of people are stuck.
Yeah.
There. And I so just fix the world.
I was going to say that I don't know if we even need to go on. I don't know if we need to go on. I think our stain removal power rivals that of OxyClean. We have removed the stain of ignorance, Jerry.
So wait, that was relevant after all?
I'm kind of impressed at myself at tying that back in. I'm not going to lie.
You know, Jerry,
speaking of solving ignorance, we just removed a stain, much like OxyClean with its amazing. Man, they're getting some free publicity out of us. I'm just saying.
Yep. OxyClean.
Come on, OxyClean. Well, I do. I really do. I love so much that I'm going to repeat it again. The fact that you said it, because it's such a concise way to put an actually complicated truth that, once we have the answer to a question, we stop asking.
We stop asking. Why would you ask a question if you already know the answer?
Yeah, but in all reality, like you said, that's the key to so much, is there's, you know, we don't even understand the capacity of what we're asking a lot of the time, you know. Not that my experience in Spain wasn't valid, but it wasn't an all-encompassing, you know. And I'm so glad that I've had many more experiences in Spain. So, you know, to the nation of Spain.
Me too.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for welcoming me back, even though I wrote you off for a little while. I apologize, and I will do better. I will do better.
Yep.
I will do better. And speaking of better, Jerry, you know what we tend to like better when we're choosing furniture? We tend to like furniture that we helped build. In fact, it's called, our next cognitive bias is called the IKEA effect, that we place higher value on things that we partially created ourselves.
Oh,
and I've heard this. This quite a bit. That because you're invested then. Like, if you helped build it, you've got, you know, probably some more intimate knowledge of it. You're invested. Now, that applies to IKEA furniture. But Jerry, I think where I've seen this take place in the expat and international world, in the world of transients and cross-cultural, whichever of those labels you want to put on it, or all of those labels, if there's enough room to stick that many on it. Yeah. I think where that happens sometimes is in social groups. Like, I can think of times where where I have built a social group, where, you know, I arrived at a place and I had to build up a social group from scratch. I got there and I didn't know anybody, so I gathered people together. I gathered a ragtag group of whoever's and said, look, we're a group now. We're interdependent. It's great. We have community. Woohoo! And then, you know, a new person comes in and you're just so proud. You're like, look at this social group that I have created. We're marvelous. Who wouldn't want to be a part of this? But it's not, groups aren't always everyone's cup of tea. You know, the kind of group that I want to hang out with might like to drink tea, and then a coffee drinker comes in.
Right.
And they don't value my tea drinking group quite as much. And in reality, you know, I think we can.
Wait, I feel attacked. is this a pot shot? On my country,
not at all,
because
Jay.
We don't like your tea?
No, I mean, it's just we built this tea, Jerry, and so I'm very partial to it.
I brewed this
cup myself, so I am attached, and you should enjoy it. I let the tea bag steep, Jerry. I put milk in afterward, Jerry.
I have so much to learn about tea. Yeah,
so much, Jerry.
Admittedly. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do. I think you know, at not just social groups, but all sorts of structures that perhaps we create, we sometimes underestimate how much we're attached to them because we had a part in building them. And it may be worth bearing that in mind when other people are exposed to them, that actually, you know, and I can think of even I've seen it, you know, with students where, there's a tight-knit group of students. They've worked really hard to do that. You know, international schools,
right,
kids are
right,
aware
sure.
that they come and go, and then they can't understand why, you know, the new kid who comes in doesn't want to automatically be part of their group. I mean, why wouldn't they? And it could well be, you know, we do have different tastes, but maybe we take that a little more personally, and maybe we don't see that it's just a difference in taste because we're like, no, I built this. Like, I brought these people together. So I think what I'm saying, we might IKEA affect people as well.
Like, it would be really interesting to dissect that, as we do often from your perspective and my perspective, from the TCK perspective and from the monocultural kind of like growing up in a homogenous culture perspective.
And then taking a leap, as you did.
And then taking a leap. Because I think the same principles are at play. I think the timing gets crunched, right? Mm-hmm. So very much where I come from, like if you don't come from the place that these people are from, if you move in late, it you can't break in. Like you can't become a part of us. It would take you years to actually connect and relate to this group of people. And I think the more tight knit and the more homogenous a group of people is, the more this is a reality. But like moving into a small community of people who have been there for 100 years, right? Like their families that have represented this community for a long time. It's impossible to break into that. Like you can make friends. You can be nice and people will be nice to you, very friendly, but you'll never become a part of that community. Like when I talk about that, how does that transfer into a TCK community?
Well, it's a really valid point. And I think it's one of the big difficulties that TCKs can face when they leave sort of the international or the transient context, because there's a big difference between being the new kid in a school full of new kids. There's a big difference being the new kid in a school full of transients and being the new kid in a school where everyone has always just been together, where everyone, you know, started out in
preschool,
the beginning,
right?
And just continued through grades. And what came to mind, Jerry, is I remember hearing a podcast, because I listen to podcasts sometimes other than our own, which is silly because ours has everything anyone would ever need.
What?
All the stain-removing power you could ask for is right here in Diesel and Clean. But I remember hearing a podcast once that was just talking about like the origins of surnames, and which was just funny little anecdotal information. But one of the points they made as relating to this is that when we hear a surname that's a place – we'll associate, we're like, you know, if you know someone named, you know, Johnny Norway, that you're like, oh, right. Well, you know, his family way back when must have come from Norway. But actually, usually if your name had a place, it's because you were an outsider. Because within Norway, there'd be no good reason to call you Johnny Norway. So what that means is, yeah, your ancestry may have come from Norway, but it was a transplant there. Because it means that you, Johnny Norway, is descended of whoever who came to somewhere else. And they were like, oh, he's... You know, he's not that basically that name made you stand out. So if you were if you were Johnny Norway, that place name probably meant that, you know, you're a transplant somewhere else. And so I think it's kind of like that. So for TCKs, you know, they're always going to have that tag. They're always going to be someone else. Yeah. No matter how long they're there, you know, Johnny Norway, his ancestors may have moved to Ireland, you know, 800 years ago. And they've been there 800 years, but his surname will always be Norway. He's always going to be, he didn't become Johnny Ireland. He became and has been known as Johnny Norway, descendant of blah, blah, blah. So it is, I think TCKs, you know, maybe struggle with the same thing that they're like, look, I've been here for so long and you still call me something else. I'm reminded of, I have friends in Germany, and I think an issue there that I remember discussing with some of my friends I have a friend there who is German and he's born in Germany. His parents were born in Germany, but his grandparents immigrated from Turkey. And he makes the point that he does not appreciate being referred to as Turkish, because he's like, I haven't even been. Like, I was born here.
Yeah, sure.
I'm German. In fact, my parents were born here. It's my grandparents who were, but because of the tone of his skin and everything, it's still it's the kind of that surname effect again. You get labeled with something displaced even generations later, and it struck me, you know, that as far as identity goes, that's a big deal. You know, your ability to blend in, and
it's a big deal. It's a big deal differently in different regions of the world. Right. Like in a more homogenous area, you either are or you're not. Right. Mm-hmm. And in some regions, there's this confusion. Like I think about from a U.S. perspective that I don't know if you've seen the kind of viral videos, the comedic videos about like, hey, where are you from? Right. Like where do you come from? No, really, where do you come from? No, before that, where do you come from? Right. Like that whole ignorance that that we're so famous for. But in other parts of the world, it's a pretty straightforward common question. Like, you're obviously not from here. Where do you come from? Right. Like living in China, that was the first question that we were asked. Right. But living in the US, it's actually an offensive question. Like, where do you come from? Right. Yeah. It is complicated.
Well, and to take that further, so I wonder, you know, talking about the IKEA effect, I wonder then at something I heard from someone marvelously clever at a conference somewhere. You know,
was it me?
It was you, Jerry. It was you. all the stain fighting power I'll ever need.
You had me at marvelously clever.
But so what they were talking about, you know, the power of what diversity brings, you know, and this is a very complicated, you know, issue, immigration and everything, far more complicated than my pay grade can go into, but.
Oh, let's fix it.
I'd say, oh, okay, got it. No worries. But I do remember this speaker said, you know, that actually this IKEA effect, they didn't mention it like that, but that they see it on a community level, that actually you have the people who had to come in and fight harder to build a sense of belonging and community, and they tend to value it more because they had to fight for it.
Sure.
And I can see that as being very true. And I think that's the IKEA effect, you know, playing out, good, bad, or otherwise. I mean, I can see where that's good, where, if you immigrate, and millions of people around the world do, if you immigrate to a new location, you're going to have to work a little harder in that new location to fit in, to build community. So you're going to value it more because of the IKEA effect, because you've worked hard to build the sense of belonging. Whereas, you know, the people around you, if they were born into it, probably not as valuable.
But then, like you said,
I can see the flip side of that where it could be way harder to break into certain places. So I find the IKEA effect fascinating.
It is fascinating.
It's so much more than furniture. I actually think the biggest examples of it are with people.
Side note, IKEA, thumbs up or thumbs down?
Oh, Jerry, I have mixed feelings. I love IKEA furniture. I really do. Partially because, you know, you do get to build it and you have a sense of ownership. But Jerry, I'll be honest with you. I try everything I can to avoid having to physically go to an IKEA because it infringes on my freedoms, Jerry. I'm going to lean toward the very, very American side of me. And I want the freedom that when I enter a building, I get to choose when to leave. And I do not like the idea that IKEA says, no, you've got to run through our entire
park. You need to see everything.
Nope. I want to go to a regular store where I can where I can just leave what I want. I do not like like my hindered egress. I do not care for it.
Yep.
It makes me feel very trapped. And then I have to go cry into a pillow and that upsets them. But thankfully there are a lot of pillows to cry into in IKEA.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, there is that.
And like, I agree. And at the same time, I appreciate the business model of you're not getting out of here until you look at everything, right? And here's some ice cream and some meatballs.
Yep.
In the middle, like right in the middle, right? Like cheap.
Yeah.
Honestly cheap.
I feel like they at least owe you that though. Like I don't think
that's fair. Yeah. Like I feel like that's the link that makes it work, because otherwise everyone would come out of there mad because they're buying three times as much as they came in to buy.
Yeah.
But hey, I got some meatballs for $1.50. Yeah.
That speaks to something about humanity that we're like, you trapped me. Oh, but you fed me. Okay. I think basically what we're deciding here, and we're probably never going to get endorsements from IKEA for this, is that IKEA has just marketed Stockholm Syndrome. That's all it is. IKEA has just marketed Stockholm Syndrome. They kidnap us, and somehow we like them for it because of the meatballs. So there we go. IKEA marketing.
I'm on the other side of Stockholm Syndrome, though. Like, I'm like, I like them. I like them. Really. It was a good experience. They got a lot of neat stuff. And when I buy it, I get the thrill of putting it together.
The IKEA effect. From now on, I will remember the IKEA effect, not just because it doesn't apply as much, I think, to furniture as it does to people, but also because it's basically just a cover for marketing Stockholm Syndrome. Just throwing it out there.
Yep.
Just throwing it out there.
Okay. Yeah. We're never done with IKEA.
Yeah. We're never getting endorsements from IKEA. OxiClean. I think we're still in the running.
OxiClean. We should be good.
Sponsor us. They could, but IKEA, I think that ship has sailed. Let's throw in a word that I don't know how to pronounce. Let's go. Cause that's a fun part of the
show. I'll pronounce it for you. Like, I feel like I'm good at pronouncing words, especially words from around the world. Go ahead.
This one is. So this is an effect. It's named after a Lithuanian-born Russian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called I'm going to do my best. The Zeigarnik effect. Zeigarnik.
Yeah, no, that was way off.
Sorry. How should it be?
Yeah, we're just, let's just roll with that.
Okay. For now. We'll go for now.
I don't want to embarrass you or
That's fine. Yeah. That's fine. We can to spell it. It's Z or Z, depending on where you're from. Eigarnik. Zeigarnik.
Yeah,
is how I'm going with it. So
but nothing Zeigarnik like you pronounce it, but
right.
But,
yeah. Totally different. That is where this one stuck with me. That is where we remember incomplete tasks more than completed ones. Now that one sounds very, very simple, but I feel like there's a pretty common phase in transition where we just hit an overwhelmed sort of point. I think it's pretty common to feel overwhelmed in transition. I would say even just beyond cultural transition, just any transition, you know, to a new job, to whatever, there's usually a point of, and I wonder how much the Zeigarnik effect plays into that, that actually we get overwhelmed because of we focus and probably unfairly on everything that either still needs done or hasn't been done yet. And we tend to overlook how much we have accomplished. Like I coming in as an outsider, you know, if I'm speaking to, if I've spoken at schools and I met families who are in the throes of transition. And it's sometimes I think helpful to remind them, say, do you know how far you've come? Like you up and left everything.
Right.
To this new place. Like you're alive, you're all fed, you figured out public transport. Like you have accomplished so many things. And it's worth focusing on that. Yes, there's still more to do. And yes, you may not feel fully integrated yet, but my gosh, it's worth remembering you've come a long way. So that's the effect, is where we remember focus on incomplete tasks more than completed ones.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite exercises when I would, part of my job used to be, connecting with people who were in transition, right? Like they were in their first year, their second year of cultural transition, country transition. These are people who have signed on. Typically they've signed on for 2 years. They've signed on for a 24-month contract. And one of the points that I would go meet with them was about 3 months in, 2 to 3 months in, and just say, hey, we talked about this stuff. We did the training back in a couple months ago, right? Like we started talking about what this experience might be like. And now you're 2 months in, what's going on for you? And they're falling apart. Like those are the people that are just absolutely falling apart.
It's a rough point.
And absolutely. And I loved it because I got to stand up and I got to say, stand right here, right? Like you stand right here. And then I would take 24 steps out, right? Like I would walk 24 steps away from them and I would turn around and I'm across the room and I would look and I would have to yell, okay, you see where I am, right? And then I would walk all the way back to 3 steps out, right? And I could reach out and touch them and I could say, this is where you are right now, right? Like you have 21 more steps to go before you even finish your first contract, your first 2 year experience with this. And yet you're summing everything up in this 3 month experience. Like this is all you have. This is the full picture that you have. Your whole experience is completely summarized in this 3 months, but you're barely started. You have a very small perception of what this is going to look like. Give yourself the space to grow. Like give yourself the space to understand and to continue growing and to continue understanding more and more and more and more. But we do, like we stop and we think that we understand the full picture right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. We got to give ourselves a little grace. That's just all there is to it. We it's hard, I think, to look at the whole, it's hard to look at the whole journey. You know, I think maybe this one, this cognitive bias has to do with how we deal with kind of tense and where we're facing. And, you know, sometimes people can be way too forward facing and ignore the past. People can be way too backward facing and be stuck back there. But it, you know, maybe balancing out, being able to say, look what I've accomplished, as well as look at what I still have to go.
Yeah, I've you know, actually come so far, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it when expats who move to a country get the opportunity not to go home for the holidays, whatever the holidays are, whether it's Christmas or New Year's or that kind of that holiday season. Like it's always a dangerous thing to go home for the holidays. But when they get to have people from where they are from come to visit them for the holidays, because they've only been there for 3-4 months, and then they get this, like their constant pain, their everyday pain is how insufficient they are in this new culture, how little they understand. But when you bring somebody who is just 3 months away, 3 months ago, they were exactly the same, and you bring them over, and they get to see, like, okay, you know 30 words in this language. You know how to get from point A to point B. You know how to get in a taxi and go across town. You like there's so much that you have learned in this 3 months, and there's like this avalanche. There's like this standing in front of a fire hydrant and being washed away by how much I have learned in this 3 months. I'm actually doing okay. I'm actually learning. I'm growing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's
a cool experience.
Oh, it's a healthy thing. It's a healthy thing. You know what? I could apply it to this very podcast, Jerry, because you know what? Did we unpack the entire world? No, we have not. There's a lot still to do. But you know what we did unpack? A lot. We unpacked a lot. Our to-do list. We've gotten rid of a stain or two. I would
argue. On our way. Yep.
And if you combine them all, here's I've been thinking about this, Jerry. I'm not gonna lie. If you combine them all, I feel like it's a pretty exciting way to look at the world. Because we started with just world really hypothesis. Is, yeah. Yeah. Started with just world, moved on to anchoring. Then we talked about the IKEA effect and closed with the Zagarnik effect. And so really just constantly remembering that the world isn't always fair. You know, that's going to help us not to seek revenge where we don't need to. And as I think you summed up angering so well, the ability to continue asking, even once we have an answer, don't just go with your first piece of information. And we value what we build more. And we've accomplished a lot. Bear that in mind, you know, don't just focus on the uncompleted task. That's a pretty encouraging little manifesto to move forward with, I feel.
You're welcome, world.
You're welcome, world. Jerry and I do our best. Yes, it's a stain-ridden existence. But my gosh, with our highly oxygenated bubbles, whether it's grease and grime in the bathroom, the kitchen, or the garage, stubborn stain. Whew, much like OxyClean, we're going to take care of it.
OxyClean is something good. Yeah.
We've done well. And I don't even think we oversold our pitch to OxyClean in this one. I think it was subtle. No. I think it was subtle.
You think? that part about OxyClean, please sponsor us. Like, was that?
It's pretty subtle.
Is that subtle?
And you know what? If this week doesn't work, Jerry, next week's episode is just going to be one giant apology to IKEA. That's all there is. Next week. Next episode's just going to be how great IKEA is and how I take back everything I ever did to associate them with Stockholm Syndrome.
Thank you for your meatballs, IKEA.
We do. Jerry, thanks for unpacking Cognitive Bias Part 2.
I love it. I love it. Always a pleasure. Always a joy. Thank you,
Chris. And there's so much more to come. Lester, the listener, thank you for joining us. May your laundry smell ever fresh and never be sullied by the stains of cognitive bias.
Wow. You just brought that whole thing together. Yeah.
Kind of proud.